Die entrepreneur, skrywer en motiveringsspreker Eric Etmedius het 'n passie vir gesondheid. Eric glo dat die COVID-19 pandemie 'n wekroep vir ons elkeen was om weer te kyk na ons gesondheid en wat ons verhouding met kos en ons eetgewoontes is. Marula Media het met Eric gesels om meer uit te vind oor hom, die werk wat hy doen en wat sy benadering tot gesondheid en gesonde eetgewoontes is.
Well, I think we should start with this. Ek is 'n Afrikaner. You know, I was born in Pretoria. I know I don't sound like it, but my grandmother's last name was Van Wyk and her husband's last name was Du Toit. Like I'm about as Afrikaans as you can get from a DNA perspective. And I mention that because that's actually where some of my original fascination with nutrition comes up, is that my other grandfather was an archaeologist and zoologist who discovered at Florispot in South Africa, the oldest Homo sapiens skull in history up until recently. And so even as a young child, I was really fascinated by evolutionary biology and that sort of stuff. And then later, when I got into my early 20s, I was really unhealthy and sick and dealing with a lot of problems. And I'd been going to see doctors and specialists, but really not getting anywhere. And a few people inspired me to think about food a little bit. And, you know, I was eating normally as far as I could tell, but I made some changes. And over the course of the next month, I changed my life so dramatically that I just became insanely curious about why we all live in this semi-perpetual state of illness when we don't have to. And I started talking to my doctors about it. Like, I was like, well, I remember asking one of my doctors how much time he'd spent in medical school to become a doctor. And he told me 6 years to become a GP. And then I asked, well, in that 6 years, how much of that time, you know, did you spend studying food and nutrition? And it was none. And that blew me away. Like, I was 21 years old and it blew me away. It was like changed my entire perception of the world. It was like, I can't imagine taking my car to a mechanic who's never studied oil or gas or transmission fluid. Like, how can you not? And that's what began my journey. I really started thinking a lot about health and nutrition at that point. And I'll tell you, you know, there was a really big turning point. I was actually on my way flying to Joburg. And I was on a Virgin Atlantic plane and I was doing a photo assignment for them. They wanted me to go shoot some photography of people horseback riding in the Waterberg. And so I went off to the Waterberg, but I'm on the plane and I'm getting ready to go. And on the plane, I'm reading this article about captive elephants. And they're talking about that elephants that were in zoos and circuses in the late 1800s, they would go capture it, but it would only live 6 or 7 years. But that was fine. They didn't know how long they're supposed to live and they recovered their investment. So it was okay. But then they started finding out that elephants in the wild could live like 70 years. So it was like, whoa, we could get a lot more return on our investment. How do we get our elephants to live longer? And so as I'm reading this article, they start talking about comparing the captive elephants with the wild elephants, which is a good comparison. But then they started talking about the elephant's wild diet and the elephant's captive diet. And I thought, well, that's not right. The elephants don't have a wild diet. They have an evolved diet, like their actual diet. Their actual diet is to eat 200 kilograms of bark and grass and a little bit of seasonal fruit every day and to drink 70 liters of water. That's their diet. And anything else is not their diet. So it's not wild diet versus captive diet. It's elephant diet versus human-fed garbage diet, which is going to result. And as I was on the plane reading this, I thought, oh my God, we totally used the word diet wrong. We think diet means temporary change to our normal way of life to achieve a short-term goal. But if you think about it, your normal way of life is your diet. So in a sense, it's not like you go on a diet, it's actually go off your diet. And the reason that's a problem is most of us have a really particularly not great diet. So we go off that diet onto another not great diet, and then we go back to our original diet and we wonder why nothing changes.
Eric is een van die mense wat in die hoogtepunt van die pandemie homself op Twitter sterk uitgespreek het dat die fokus om COVID-19 te bekamp nie op die regte plekke lê nie. Hy meen daar word steeds nie genoeg gefokus op die waarde van goeie voeding en gesonde eetgewoontes in die stryd teen die virus nie.
I would put to you that I probably was maybe the first person to say that. I started saying it in February and then in March 14th I released a video and I said, listen, social distancing, do all this stuff they're telling you. But don't rely on that stuff. I said, you got to take care of your last line of defense, and that is your immune system. You've got to be healthy. You got to not put lots of garbage in right now. And I gave a whole talk on this, and it went medium viral. A couple million people have seen it. But what happened was a lot of doctors and nutritionists and scientists attacked me and said, well, you don't have, you know, a degree. You don't know what you're talking about. You know, what business do you have making this advice? And some people even accused me of saying that if you took care of your diet, you didn't need to wear a mask or you wouldn't need the vaccine. I never said anything of the kind. What I said was, if you are fundamentally healthy, your body is in better condition to fight the virus. Being healthy won't stop you catching it, but being healthy might help you fight it. Now, I said that back in February and March. Now, the data is clear. You know, it's absolutely clear. The CDC, even about 2 weeks ago, came out and said that only 6% of the mortality that they've seen with COVID-19 has been healthy people, that almost all, all other deaths have been as a result of somebody having comorbidities or other diseases, most of which are what they call lifestyle diseases. Now, I don't like that they call them lifestyle diseases because I believe that they call them lifestyle diseases to blame us. It's like, oh, you have a lifestyle disease. Oh, you're lazy. Oh, you eat too much. And what we really have is a broken food system disease. It's not a lifestyle disease. It's a system where the food manufacturers have been lobbying and changing regulations and legislations, and they've been making manipulative ad campaigns. And so people are confused about what to eat. And so that's why we have such a big problem. And I'll really answer your question like this. I imagine it like this. What if COVID-19 escaped from its cave or its lab or its bat? I don't care where it came from. What if it escaped from wherever it came from into the population in 1955? And I would say to you, nothing. It would have been like, oh yeah, there was a disease. It got a few people. Mostly it got people that were sick already, but there wasn't enough illness in the population for it to gain purchase and become a spreader. You know, if you think about it, if there are 100 people and 50% of them are obese or diabetic or have hypertension or have autoimmune disease, then that's 50% of the people that can spread the disease very easily. But if only 10% of the population has those diseases, it's a lot harder for the disease to spread. And so I really believe that we have handled this badly. I am not saying that there shouldn't have been lockdowns. I'm saying some places should have locked down and probably others shouldn't. That's not the issue. I'm not saying we should or shouldn't wear masks. I think some people in some populations should be and others shouldn't be. But I think every population should be taking a look at their food supply, food regulations, and all that stuff. And they should, every single person, as a matter of public safety, should be getting their relationship with food under control, turning around diabetes, ending obesity, and all that sort of thing.
As die pandemie dan die oproep is om ons verhouding met kos te verander, wou ek by Erik weet, waar en hoe moet 'n mens met hierdie verandering begin?
Well, there's a couple of different ways. The one is, you could say, well, nobody is ever going to care as much about my health as I do, so I'm going to go and study. I'm going to go learn. The trouble is, where are you going to learn? Because right now, you can go become a doctor and never learn about food. And if you go to study nutrition, and I'm really sorry to say this, but you're going to go and study education that was sponsored by the food industry in the first place. A number of times in history, particularly in the United States, which generally spreads out to the world very often, there's been food regulations that have been created. It happened in the 1950s, happened again in the 1970s. And each time, once they've created the guidelines, they then hand the guidelines off to the food industry, you know, because they have a vital interest in, you know, making sure that it's right. And of course, then the food industry comes in and says, oh, no. You can't have it like that. If you have it like that, we're going to go bankrupt. And so the food regulations end up getting broken. So that means today, the education and information we have is largely bought and paid for. So, all right. That means that if you go to PubMed or you go study some, you go look for some study. Yep, you can go get a peer-reviewed study. I'll bet you, you could right now go find one peer-reviewed study that said milk is so good for humans. And I'll bet you, you can go find another peer-reviewed study that says milk is really bad for people. And then that leaves consumers confused. So I have a different system. If you, let's say you wanted to get a caracal, okay? You wanted to get yourself a caracal. And so you're going to get yourself a caracal. There you go. You've got it set up. And so you've got now, how are you going to find out what your caracal is supposed to eat? Are you going to go to PubMed? Are you going to go to Johns Hopkins University? Are you going to go hire a nutritionist? Or are you going to watch a nature program and find out what the caracal eats? You know, it's like, or Roycut, if you prefer. But the point being is that you're going to go watch the Big Cat Diaries. And somebody's going to come on there and go, the caracal is a wonderful beast, you know, whatever. Like, yeah. And this is what it eats. It eats birds. It eats fresh birds. That's what it eats. And you're like, oh, I'm going to have to go get some fresh birds for my caracal. That's how you'd know. If you're going to get yourself a baby hippopotamus, you go like, wow, I'm going to need a big garden. What does a hippopotamus eat? Oh, it doesn't eat anything in the water, funny enough. It lives in the water, but it comes out of the water at night and it eats all these plants. And it doesn't eat that plant, but it does eat that plant. And then you know. And so if you want to find out what humans should be eating, there are two very good sources. The one is the archaeological record. Like, we know what humans have eaten all through history. We know that. In fact, I'll tell you something. A lot of my research about this and a lot of my experience as a human being has come from South Africa. My grandparents used to own a house on the middle of Plettenberg Bay Beach, right there. Like, if you're standing right there in the middle of the beach, that's their house. So as a child, I would go there and I would explore. And sometimes if I was very brave, I'd walk all the way out to Raaburg. And you'd go out to Raaburg. Well, you know what? Out at the end of Raaburg, there are caves. And, you know, my great-grandfather, he excavated those caves and explored them back in the, because you know what? People have been living in those caves. Like, just think about this for a minute. If you live in Canada and your house is old, it's like 80 years old. But if you live in London and your house is old, it's like, you know, maybe 300, 400 years old. If you go to Croatia, your house might be 700 years old. If you go to Egypt, the pyramids are 3,500 years old. These give some time frames, right? The caves on Raaburg have been, until modern times, have been continuously lived in for 200,000 years. And you know what's really cool? They cut down into the floor. They cut down into the floor and then they put glass. So you can go down some steps and you can look at 200,000 years of cave litter. What's cave litter? It's when people live in a cave and they eat stuff and they throw it over their shoulder and the cave floor grows and grows and each generation doesn't notice it happening, but the cave floor, slowly their place is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right? And so you can go and look at exactly what people have been eating for 200,000 years. It's not a mystery. So we have the archaeological record that we can look at. And then the other thing we can do is we can go and track down some of the last, like, truly nomadic hunter-gatherers that are living the way our ancestors lived. Long before Europeans showed up in Africa, how were people living in Southern Africa at that point? And you know, okay, we don't have any of those people left really in South Africa. There are some in very, very, I think, Northwest South Africa, into Namibia, into Southwest Africa. There's some in that area. And there's another group of them that lives in Tanzania called the Hadza people. And I have for 10 years been visiting the Hadza people, watching the way they hunt, watching the way they gather, looking at the plants they eat and understanding them. Now, what I would say to you is that our food supply is definitely broken and it's been twisted and manipulated by the food industry. It's been twisted and manipulated by the pharmaceutical industry. We're in trouble. And so now we as people, we need to learn it for ourselves. We can't trust it to some manufacturer who's making money on us. We can't do that anymore. We have to take a look at doing it for ourselves. And those are two very good ways to find out. Study our past or study our cousins that are still living that way today and give us some sense. I'm not saying that the way they live is exactly the way we were, but I'm saying it's the closest example that we have.
Talle mense het hulle tot emosionele eetgewoontes gewend in 'n poging om die spanning van afsondering en al sy uitdagings te hanteer. Nog 'n probleem is dat sommige mense sukkel om gewig af te skud as hulle met verhoogde vlakke van kortisol sit, die streshormoon.
Let's first talk about stress chemicals, cortisol, adrenaline, and that sort of stuff. So they're quite dangerous. They're not designed the way we use them. And the reason being is that we live very different lives than our ancestors lived. In fact, this is a difficult thing for people to acknowledge sometimes, but we live in the safest times in the history of ever. Like, the generations that were born after about 1960, they have lived in the safest times in the history of times. Sure, we've had some, you know, a few esoteric or existential even threats like the Cold War and that kind of stuff. But if I was my age, born in 1900, by the time I was 20 years old, I've already gone through World War I, then the Spanish flu, then the Great Depression, then World War II, then the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, it was an incredibly dangerous time to be alive on Earth. And we live in the safest times ever. So one of the challenges is that we have old software and hardware that's designed for when things were dangerous. And that's what the cortisol and adrenaline's for. So let me put it to you in very practical South African terms. If you and I are, let's say we're at Bergendal, and we walk out of Bergendal camp in the southern section of the Kruger National Park, and we walk out into the bush, okay? We walk out into the bush. Now, there's a good chance that we're going to see some stuff, like there's going to be all kinds of animals, and even on foot, we might see a few things. But we might look out across the river, and about half a mile away, we might see some lions. Now, they're half a mile away. So do we need cortisol or adrenaline right now? No. No, we don't. We don't at all. Now, the truth is most people would start developing cortisol and adrenaline because they're not familiar with that. But I have routinely been walking through Kruger and seen lions. By the way, never walking without a guide, always with permission and with a guide. But the point being is I've many times walked around, like many times. One time in particular, I walked around a corner and there were 14 lions in the river. 14. And they were only maybe 150 meters away, right? Like they were close. So, but in that moment, if you don't know better, you're going to start raising adrenaline and cortisol. What is adrenaline and cortisol? It's basically like software instructions for your body to take over. It's clearly now more dangerous than your mind can handle. And so as you produce adrenaline and cortisol, your connection with logic, you know, like becomes very basic, up, down, side, side, yet not no complex logic, just basic logic. And our general intelligence takes a dip because we don't need complex thinking here. Just, and then the other thing that happens is we lose empathy. We lose empathy for others. And the best example I can give you this is that you can have somebody drowning in the water and somebody they love very much can try to rescue them and they will climb on top of that person and drown them in their panic because they have no empathy when they're in panic. Now, the trouble is that one of the things that this whole pandemic has done is it's put a lot of people in panic all the time. The funny part though is, and it's not funny at all, is that the lion they're panicking about is half a mile away. See, a lot of people are panicking about, am I going to get evicted from my house? Maybe, but probably not for 3 months, right? Or am I going to lose my job? Could be, but not right now. Most of it is stuff that we're worried about in the future. So we're producing all this adrenaline cortisol, which is making us a little less smart, a little less logical, and a little less caring and empathetic, as you can see online. You can see the way people talk to each other and the aggression and so on. So now the other two problems with this that are very important is that when you start raising your stress chemicals, your body goes, uh-oh, dangerous times are ahead. And if you have the chemicals for a long time, the body starts thinking, wow, I might need stored up energy and water because God knows how long this danger is going to last. And so that triggers the body to store fat. Cortisol, stress says, oh, I better store fat because God knows how long this danger is going to be present. I need, you know, I might need to go for a few days or weeks without food, so I'd better store fat. And so it triggers fat gain. And then one more thing, and this is really creepy. It subjugates your immune system. And basically the way to think about it is that as I'm standing out there in the bush, and this happened to me once, I'm walking along and I turned around a rock and there was a female lion sitting about 15 to 20 feet away from me. That's scary. That's a really scary experience. And in that moment, what's more important, that my immune system protects me from the pollen in the air or from the viruses and bacteria that might be floating around, or that my body protects in that moment, my body needs to protect me from the immediate danger. And so it's not going to go, well, we'll give 50% of the energy to the fight or flight response and 50% of the energy to the immune response. No, the body goes, lower the shields, divert all power to strength and speed. And so as you increase your stress, you're doing that to fight. You're doing that to run. And so the problem is that in that moment, your shields are down. And so you suppress your own immune function by allowing yourself to live in a constant state of stress. And the media are doing it to us because they know something. When you feel uncertain, you look for certainty. And in the old days, we used to go to the news channel for certainty. Oh, look, it's bad, but it's not that bad. And so the trouble is now is the news is scaring the hell out of us all the time because they know the more they scare us, the more we'll come back. And so our immune systems are being subjugated. Our fat retention is getting higher. And in a recent study I saw, it said something like 3 out of 4 Americans have gained something like 17 pounds, or maybe it was kilograms, but a lot of weight in just 3 months. And so we have to do something about that. And one of the first things we can do about it is we can keep calm and carry on, as they say in Britain. We can slow it down a little, do some breathing exercises, take some time in nature, spend time with our loved ones, watch movies and TV shows that make us laugh, not the ones that... This is not the time for watching The Walking Dead. This is the time for watching Happy Gilmore. You know, this is the time for watching stuff that's going to make you giggle and feel good. And so I think that's a big part of what we need to do differently in this new age of viral pandemics.
Boonop het van ons slegte eetgewoontes in die tyd van die inperking aangeleer, wat ons nou weer sukkel om af te leer.
One of the things that's interesting about people is that we have, it's like we have this app, and the app basically says this. Remember that survival for our ancestors was very unlikely, you know, 80% infant mortality. So right out of the gate, the game was tough. And then even after that, it was really tough. Like I often think about what life would have been like for that Florispad man 250,000 years ago. But then I even think to myself, what life must have been like for Louis Tricard and these guys coming across in the wagons across Africa. I mean, it was dangerous. Compared to what we face, it was dangerous. And so weirdly, I think we have this app inside, and the app says this: if I'm alive on Tuesday, whatever I did on Monday must be good. Now, because our life is so safe today, we do a ton of stupid stuff on Monday. We're still alive on Tuesday, but our body goes, well, we're still alive. Keep doing the dumb stuff. And so if you do that for 21 days in a row, you take a behavior and you turn it into an automatic behavior, otherwise known maybe as a habit. And so what happened for a lot of people, you can tell me if it was like this for you or any of you guys out there. I'd love to hear your story on maybe Instagram. Come and find me. But I'll tell you, this is what I think. I think that when they first told us about the lockdown around the world in most places, they go, it's just going to be 2 weeks. Didn't they? That's what they said. So it's going to be 2 weeks, we think, maybe a little more. And so you know what? We went to the grocery store and we bought food. It's just 2 weeks. We may as well get the frozen pizza and the ice cream and the marshmallows. It's treat time, right? And so we went and bought deplorable, convenient, long-lasting food because we didn't know if we'd be able to go shopping the next week. And we didn't go. And I went to many grocery stores and friends of mine sent videos to me from all around the world. And what I saw in the grocery stores was empty frozen pizza box and empty frozen pizza section, empty frozen TV dinner section, empty ice cream section, full meat and fish section, full fruits and vegetables section. What the hell? But everybody kind of thought, yeah, but it's just 2 weeks. We may as well just sit and burn out in front of Netflix and eat garbage, right? It's only 2 weeks. Only then it became 3 weeks. Then it became 4 weeks. And pretty soon we'd passed over the 21-day mark. And now some of these habits have become automatic. And we got to figure out how to break them. And that's tough. And that's what we really specialize at WildFit. We really work on people's psychology around their food decisions. But I can give you something right now. I want to give you something right now. Here's my hack for you. It's a WildFit hack, but it works like this. If you reward your body, it will repeat behavior. So if you are depressed about something or fearful and you decide to use chocolate to feel better about your fear or your depression, your body will slowly start to learn, it'll quickly start to learn that fear or depression is the path to the chocolate. So 2 days later, your body might go, wow, I'd love to have some of that caffeine and all that fat and all that sugar. I'd love to have that. And your body goes, well, how do we get it? Well, we could send up a chocolate craving. Yeah, but he's got pretty good willpower. I don't think, you know what we could do? We could make him depressed. We could make him a little fearful and depressed. All right, release the fear and depression chemicals. And they start coming into you. And the next thing you know, you go have the chocolate. So what I would suggest is that when you decide to treat yourself, you should always treat yourself well. And you should always reward emotional states and behaviors that you want to repeat. So you don't go, well, I had a really bad day and I'm really mad and I'm sad and I had an awful day, so I'm going to have a bowl of ice cream. No, no. You go, you know what? I've had a really bad day. I feel really bad and I really wish I could have an ice cream, but I'm not allowed to have ice cream until I'm feeling good. So you know what? I'm going to go outside. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to call my friend. I'm going to lift myself up. And if I can honestly lift myself up so I'm feeling good, then I'll have the ice cream. Now, I'm not recommending ice cream is a good idea for anybody. I'm using this as an example that if you change that one thing about your relationship with food, you can change your whole life.
Erik verduidelik waar jy meer inligting oor sy programme kan kry en waar mense hom op sosiale media kan volg vir meer wenke en raad oor 'n gesonde verhouding met kos.
I would ask anybody, give me 14 days and I'll give you your life back. And that's because last year we launched, you know, our traditional coaching programs are 3 months. And for some people, that's a big commitment. And, you know, so what we did is we created a 14-day program that's all about food psychology. It's all about understanding your relationship with food and changing it. And so I would say, go to getwildfit.com and do our reset program. Go and do the reset. And in 14 days, you will have a completely different view of your relationship with food. Look, you don't need nobody. Nobody should ever go on a diet again. You should change your diet. That's the deal right now. But the trouble is you can't change your diet if you don't change your psychology. It's not enough to educate you. It's not enough to go, this is good, this is good, this is good, and this is bad, and this is bad, and this is bad. We already know a lot of that stuff. And yet, guess what? We don't eat enough of the good and we eat too much of the bad. So what we have to do is go in and help you understand some of the childhood linkages you've created and some of the psychological routines you use on yourself to convince yourself to eat badly. And so that 2-week program is going to give you the foundations of food freedom. So go to getwildfit.com/reset. And then here's the other thing. If you want to talk to me, please do. I handle my own Instagram account. Everything else, it's like marketing, whatever, Facebook, all that stuff. But Instagram is me personally. So if you come onto Instagram and you comment on stuff, and if you even write to me, I do the best I can to answer as many people as I can. Now, I won't give you health or coaching advice for liability reasons, but I'll point you in the right direction. So come and find me on Instagram at Eric Edmeads.
Eric, verduidelik wat die een ding is wat jy vandag nog kan begin doen om jou sielkundige verhouding met kos te verander.
One thing to understand is that the food industry includes sugar in something like 65% of food now. And the reason they do that is that sugar stimulates your appetite. Sugar makes you hungry. So the reason they put it in the food is to make you eat more than you need. That's why it's there. You know, like there's many foods where there's no need of sugar in it. You know, do you know what you now find here in America? Biltong made with sugar. Like, what are they doing? You know, it's like, no. In fact, I'm talking with a company now that makes biltong in North America, and I want them to make a Wild Fit version of it, not made with sugar, you know, and so on, because it can be such a nice, healthy snack, assuming the meat is well sourced and so on. So when you begin to understand that sugar is there as a manipulation tool, it's there to manipulate your biochemistry, to take away your free will. It's meant to make you buy more. Now, that doesn't mean you can never eat sugar again, but what I would say is, as one little exercise you can do before you come and do the 14 days with us, is just start noticing sugar on all the labels. Go and look. Now, not in the nutrition part of the label, in the ingredients. And remember that when food is labeled for ingredients, it's the ingredients are listed in the order of prevalence. Like, so in other words, when you go and you look at something like Kellogg's Rice Krispies, you'll see that the first ingredient is rice because mostly it's rice. And then the second ingredient, you might be surprised to know, is sugar because it's the second most common thing in there. And if you go and you get cornflakes, you'll find that the number one ingredient is corn and the number two ingredient is sugar. And if you get frosted flakes, what you'll find is that the number one ingredient is sugar. The number one ingredient is sugar. And we give this to our children. We should go to jail for giving that to our children. I know it's a little harsh, but maybe they should at least go to jail for making it that way. So if you want to start carving out a little freedom for yourself, what I suggest is that you just start reading it and gaining awareness about how prolific sugar is, and then start asking yourself, why is it even here? And it's there to take away your free will. It's there to rob you of food freedom. It's there to boost their profits. And one more thing, if you decide to start cutting down a little bit, one thing to do, don't pick it up, look at it and go, oh man, it's got sugar in it. Don't do that. That'll make you eat the sugar. What you got to do is instead, you got the jar in your hand, right? And you look at it and go, sugar? WTF? And then you slam the jar on the floor in the grocery store. And there you are in the spa. And no, don't do this. Don't do this. But I want you to think like that. I want you to get angry that it's there, not sad. Sad will lead to eating it. Angry will lead to freedom.